Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another of our special 12 days of the Comic Source Christmas episodes. And in this one, I'm going to be talking about the second issue of Christmas with the Superheroes. We previously covered issue number one, edited by Mark Wade. And in that first issue, the first time DC did a Christmas with the Superheroes in, I think it was 1988. No, 1987. I don't know. 87 or 88 was the first time that that DC did one of these. And that was a collection from previous holiday stories that had appeared in DC Comics. And I told you when I covered the special, which comics those had originally appeared in, and we talked about how some of them were very much of their time, especially the Teen Titans one in the 60s felt very Silver Age. The Justice League one also from 1974 was kind of interesting. It was such a different tone than you would get in a comic these days. So even though the second volume is also edited by Mark Wade, what he actually did this time was he got creators to tell new stories definitely holiday themed, but they hadn't appeared anywhere before. And a lot of these creators, they hadn't necessarily worked on DC properties before. Like the first one that we're going to talk about here, it's Ex Machina. It's by Paul Chadwick. He does the story and the pencils. John Nyber is on inks, John Costanza on letters, and Tom McGraw on colors, edited by Mark Wade. And Paul Chadwick was known for the independent comic Concrete that was published at Dark Horse for a really long time. So this story, it's a Superman story that we talk about, and it's called Ex Machina because of that saying, Deus Ex Machina, ghost in the machine, or God in the machine, rather. It's a writing term. It comes from Latin, and it means basically when something happens in a story that isn't foreshadowed at all, and it just comes out of the blue and saves the day because maybe the writer has written themselves into a corner and you need something miraculous to happen. It doesn't necessarily make logical sense. And so this is just Ex Machina, which means the machine, and you'll see why in a minute here, because something happens in the story that you wouldn't necessarily expect. At least this guy doesn't expect it, because he is stuck on the road out in the middle of nowhere. His car has broken down, and as cars drive past him in this blizzard, he's yelling, "Please stop, stop, stop!" And he's talking about how cold he is, and the dialogue boxes talk about the first bites were like a, you know, a little like a fly where it just bites you, but whatever, you don't think about it. And after three or four, you start to worry and that feeling grows. And after 15 bites, you're feeling desperate. And after 30, the pain, you know, the cumulative pain of all those has you so mad, so frustrated, you could literally kill somebody. And that's how this guy feels about the cold as another car drives by him, and he kind of sinks to his knees in the snow and says no, because his car won't run. He can't run the heater. It's broken down, and he's at the end of his rope. So he climbs back in his car. He opens his glove box. He pulls out a gun, checks to see that it's loaded, thinks to himself, what a fool she said he was to get it. But he's so cold he can barely hold the pen. And we see him write a note saying, "I'm so sorry, but no one will stop, and I just can't stand the cold." And he's putting the gun under his chin, and he's just about to pull the trigger when someone knocks on his window, and we see it's Superman. So that's where the Ex Machina comes in. That's the miracle this guy experienced. Had no business whatsoever you know, to expect Superman to come and save his life. And Superman asks if he can get in with him, and he says, "Sure, I guess." Superman says, are you cold? You look pretty cold. Could I warm you up?" And the man stammers up, "Please warm me up." And as Superman gives him a mild dose of a heat vision, the man said, "Oh, I can't tell you how good that feels. I thought I'd never be warm again." And as Superman uses X-ray vision to look at the engine, he says, "You know, I'll have to take longer to thaw your engine block and battery water, or they'll crack." And the man says, that's fine. And while Superman's looking, he says, "Yeah, it looks like you have a belt that's broken. And without that, the generator couldn't charge, and your battery must have run down. And then Superman points to the gun and asks why. And the man said, well, I was so cold. I've been here for 4 hours. Nobody was stopping. There must have been 30 cars go by. And the cold, it just hurts. I've never known so much despair. And Superman says, it's the curve. Again, he's going to think the best of people. He says, the curve, they wouldn't see you until they're right upon you. And in this blizzard, they must have been afraid to break the road's ice. That's got to be why nobody stopped. And the man's like, I suppose that could be why. And Superman says, but that's a pretty poor excuse for what you're about to do. And the man was thinking that. He says, I was thinking, why not? I don't have much. Superman says, you don't have a family, people that count on you. He said, no, in fact, I'm returning to Metropolis from Central City. I just helped my wife move. Well, I guess she's my ex-wife now. And on Christmas, and Superman said, I'm sorry to ask, but why'd you split up? And he said, I'm not going to discuss it. We promised that we wouldn't. And I hope that's all right. But what were you doing out here in the middle of nowhere? It's a long way from Metropolis. And he says, you remember that Minuteman missile that had the fuel ignite? Our workman dropped a wrench and caused a blast. And, there's still plenty of silos out here. And the man said, wait, there's been an explosion? And he said, no, nothing like that. Nothing's really happened. I can't say anymore. Please keep it to yourself. And the man says, sure, no problem at all. And Superman notices some pills in a bag on the dashboard, and he asks about them. And the man says, I have a condition. It's a degenerative condition of skin and muscles. And Superman says, well, you have my sympathy. I know that that's not a pleasant thing to deal with. And the man says, I the drugs help. And so Superman asks where he was heading. I'm heading home. I have a house there. I guess I'll try to sell it. I don't know what else to do. And my wife and I have split up. And Superman says, well, don't you have any other family to spend Christmas with? And he says, well, none to speak of. Superman won't let that go. He's like, well, what do you mean to speak of? So, well, I have a daughter, but I haven't spoken to her in years. And Superman wants to know why. Well, my wife kind of objected to who she married. And when you're married to somebody, you present a united front. And, I sided with my wife. And Superman's, well, why not call her now? You're not with your wife anymore. And the man says, be so awkward. She probably hates me for, abandoning her. And Superman says, well, I don't want to preach here, but trust me, as I know what I'm talking about. Somebody that lost his or her parents, if they had a chance to get them back, even one of them, they would jump at it. So trust me on this. It's something I know. Maybe she'll invite you for Christmas dinner. The man's like, I don't know. And Superman says, well, what I know is your disease is a long, hard road, and you shouldn't have to go through it alone. So if not for yourself, then do it for me. Give her a call. I'd like to think I didn't stop here for nothing. And so the man agrees that he'll call her, and Superman charges his generator up by hand, and the car turns over. And Superman says, you're not going to get far on just the battery. And you're not going to be able to get a belt for this, being that it's Christmas. So give me that pen and paper. And he writes down directions. And he says, I want you to go to these people. They'll give you help. They'll give you a good Christmas dinner. And you can get your car fixed tomorrow. And I says, no, I couldn't. And Superman says, nonsense. They'd love to have you, because you're not going to get far on just battery. I'll phone and let them know you're coming. They're good people. But you got to be discreet. Don't tell anybody about this. They're an older couple. They're private people. And the man says, you have my word. I won't tell anyone. And so the man drives off after wishing Superman a Merry Christmas. And as Superman flies away, we see he's dismantled the gun into pieces. And as the man pulls away, the sign says, next exit, Smallville. So obviously Superman has sent him to Ma and Pa Kent's house for a nice meal. So in a way, it's sort of depressing. Here's this poor guy about to kill himself because his wife has left him. He has a degenerative skin and muscle disease. He doesn't have his daughter, and he's freezing cold. No one will stop. But I guess it's supposed to be, but Superman is here to to remind us that there's always a reason to keep going. There's always hope. And that's what he's done for this guy. So it's not the most uplifting, but I liked it. I felt like it was a good story. And maybe the thing I liked about it best was that it showed that no individual is too small. No problem is too small. You know, for Superman to step in and give somebody hope and try to do what he can to help them. So overall, I liked it. The art, you know, it's kind of indie comic art. You know, it's like I said, it's Paul Chadwick. It's not it's not flashy, and it's pretty simple. I mean, you're talking just like 6-panel grids for each page for the most part. So it's pretty simple art, but it conveys the message. And like I said, I thought it was a good story. It's just interesting that they started with this one because it's not the most upbeat. Next up, we have a Batman story written by Dave Gibbons. Gray Morrow does the art and colors. John Constanza on letters. Again, Mark Wade editing. And it's basically this story. It doesn't have any dialogue. It's all done with boxes, just kind of exposition boxes, and it basically tells the story of the cave where Bruce fell in, juxtaposed against the Star of Bethlehem. So it starts off, it says, far across the world above, in a rough stable, a child screams. For many, his birth brings a light that may never be quenched, but not for all. For some, the darkness has no end. So here we are staring out the mouth of that cave in ancient times on the night that Christ was born. And as we move forward through time, we see various people have thought about entering the cave, but no one ever did until Bruce Wayne fell in on that fateful time when his father had to save him. And then next we see the cave when Bruce goes down, remembering he fell in after having traveled around the world and trained himself. He comes back to the cave to establish his base, and it's still dark and vast. And in the city streets above, you know, a child screams once more, reborn in death. So, you know, referencing when Bruce made his vow. And then we see Bruce and Alfred setting up the cave. And then we see Bruce bringing Dick Grayson down when he's joined by that. And Gibbons is talking about how the cold is tempered with warmth, the warmth of bringing somebody who, even though he went through the same thing Bruce Wayne did, somehow came through that tragedy unshadowed. And we see a few pages of the years of Batman and Robin. I love the exposition here. It says, the dark recedes, the winter of shadows of a man's world are pushed back as if by a new sun. And where once he sought revenge, now they find adventure. And, you know, we see different Batmobiles and different trophies and such that kind of let us know. And the costumes change as well, that let us know time is passing. And then eventually it comes time for the child to become a man. And Dick Grayson moves along and claims his freedom. But for some, there's no escape from the darkness. And once again, darkness has descended. In solitude, the drama continues, and Batman is there still trying to fulfill his mission. But no matter what happens, even as eternal as night seems escapable, there's always the greater truth that darkness without light has no meaning. For even though the night has been, it can't last forever. And as the story ends, we see that bright, shining Star of Bethlehem once again shining light into the cave. So kind of interesting, kind of meta. Like I said, with having no dialogue at all, but just these scenes, it's pretty interesting. And the other thing is Dave Gibbons, mostly known as an artist, but here telling the story with some pretty good art by Gray Morrow. So it's kind of an opinion piece on Batman, almost, about how even though he focuses on darkness, without light there can be no darkness. So there is that light to him, whether that's Alfred bringing positivity into his life or Dick Grayson as Robin. So there's always something more to it. He's more than just darkness. Next up, we have a Wonder Woman story. It's written by Eric Schanauer. He also handles the art. Colors by Tom McGraw and edited by Mark Waid. And it starts off with Diana having a dream about being pulled in different directions. And she's wondering about her place in the world and if she is doing enough. Meanwhile, the afternoon of December 23rd, a couple of Wonder Woman's friends are joining up for the holidays. So the pastor here, Sharon, shows up at the house of Julia, and they're kind of catching up on old times, what they've been up to. And Julia is told by Sharon how Sharon's longtime marriage has broken up, and her husband, Brian, had been having an affair with another woman on the church council, and he's asked for a divorce, and she's wondering if she should continue being a pastor. She's going to have to change churches if that's the case, and she feels betrayed and worthless, and Julia's trying to convince her she's not, and, you know, it's not her fault, and, you know, not to give up on the ministry. And Sharon said, I'm thinking about going back to school and maybe doing something else. And Julia's daughter, Vanessa, shows up and is really excited because she's got vacation for the next 2 weeks. Winter break has started, and Diana, Wonder Woman, is going to be there soon. So they're all really excited. And the next morning, Diana shows up and introduces herself to Sharon. And Sharon says, oh, you live such an adventurous life as a superhero. And she goes, I don't really think of myself as a superhero. And you know, I know Julia's spoken of you. You're a Christian minister, right? Like, yeah, it's that's what I do. And Wonder Woman says, I don't know much about Christian religions. What, you know, what does that mean, being a pastor? And she said, well, that's quite a question. You know, I'm a counselor. I'm a community leader. I'm an activities coordinator. The list really goes on and on, but you know, it's nothing compared to what you do. And Diana, again, you know, I don't really consider myself a superhero. I kind of assist them. I'm here in the world to tell people about the Amazon way of life and to teach people that there's a new way of living, of love and peace. So again, keep in mind, this is, you know, during the George Perez run, you know, after Crisis, where Wonder Woman had been rebooted, and it was a little bit different time. Sharon says, actually, it sounds like we have similar resumes. And Wonder Woman says, I suppose so. I was given my mission by the gods of Olympus. So our theological bases are different, but a lot of what we do does seem to be sort of similar, and we're trying to spread this message. So they decide to go inside and say hi to Julia and Vanessa. And so they spend the next hours together getting ready for Christmas dinner and enjoying each other's company. And carolers show up on Christmas Eve, and the women sing some songs of their own. And then very early on Christmas morning, after all the lights are out, Sharon gets up to play Santa Claus and go put some presents under the tree. And she finds Diana there staring out the window at the snow. And she says, oh, Diana, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to frighten you. I'm playing last minute Santa. You're not peeking at your presents, are you? She said, no, I'm just reflecting on what I've accomplished, or maybe I should say what I haven't accomplished. You know, I came to this world to teach humankind to live in peace and harmony. And I know I've done some good, but, you know, everything I've seen, from fighting the gods of Olympus to supervillains, I don't know if what I'm doing is making a difference. It feels like a waste. And Sharon hugs her and says, oh, you can't truly believe in that. And Wonder Woman says, well, I believe in love and peace. And she said, Sharon says, then hold on to those beliefs. You know, your gods may ignore your beliefs and go against them, but those beliefs are real. And that's your real God, the belief in love, the belief in peace. And, you know, for all the world needs those values. So we need you here, Diana. We need you to keep telling the world what you believe and to make it a better place. And Diana says, yeah, but nobody's listening. The people who need to hear it most are the ones that have the most hate and despair in their heart and are fighting against it. Like, what am I doing? Why do they try to shout out my voice? And Sharon again encouraging her, saying, someone's going to hear you. Someone will need to hear what you have to say, and they'll believe. You've done good already, and that good will grow. You've planted the seeds. And Wonder Woman says, that's so difficult. And Sharon, hey, believe me, if it weren't difficult, then it wouldn't be so important. And that's why it is so important. And Wonder Woman finally relents and says, you know what? You're right. I feel confused and scared, but what you're saying makes sense. And Sharon says, well, I'm scared too, but that's why we need to hold on to each other and hold on to love and peace and truth. And we have to help each other, help others hold on too. And so Christmas morning, they all exchange gifts. They're having a great time. And Sharon tells Julia, you know, I wanted to tell you that I'm not going to be leaving my ministry. I'm not going to be retreating to the cocoon of study. Like I had mentioned before, I'm going to wait for a call from a new congregation. And Julie is very happy to hear, oh, I'm so glad. What made you change your mind? Surely not because of Christmas morning. And Sharon says, no, I've just been thinking, I'm not the only one hurting in this world. And for some reason, God's given me the ability to comfort others. And I need to make sure I'm using that ability, that power to its greatest potential. And Julia says, powers? You sound like some kind of superhero. And Sharon says, what? I don't know about that, as she's looking at Wonder Woman, and Wonder Woman's smiling in the foreground. So you kind of wonder, like, did Wonder Woman know all along and sort of play like she was hurting so that Sharon could, you know, be awakened to the good she does in the world? Or did they really help each other? It's kind of left for the reader to decide. So a good story, very much appropriate, especially this time of year, especially right now in our current political climate. And with how Wonder Woman has come around and how she is so much of a symbol of hope, especially in the movies that where she's portrayed by Gal Gadot and that Patty Jenkins directs. I mean, this is exactly in that same sort of tone and feel of who Wonder Woman is. So even though this is from, you know, 1988-89, it's so perfect with who Wonder Woman is now. Really, really great story. Next up, we have an Enemy Ace story written and penciled by John Byrne, finished art by Andy Kubert, colors by Glenn Whitmore, again edited by Mark Wade. And this is a really famous one. It's called Silent Night. What's interesting is it's a silent story. There's no dialogue whatsoever. But when John Byrne went to create this, you know, he hadn't been at DC that long. He'd taken over Superman, rebooted it. And he's doing this Enemy Ace story, not the most popular of DC characters. And he asked, does Enemy Ace speak English? And he couldn't get an answer. People weren't sure from editorial if Enemy Ace actually spoke English or not, like, you know, was that in DC canon or not? So he decided just to do it as a silent issue. So it starts off with us seeing a crashed German Zero in the foreground, a building in the background, and it turns out the building is a hospital during World War II. And we see an injured soldier whose head is wrapped in a bandage, who's drawing a picture of some German fighter planes. I should say World War I, rather, Enemy Ace, so World War I. And there's another patient in the hospital who's lost a leg, who's on a crutch, who sees the pictures this guy's drawing of German planes, and he's mad, you know, obviously the implication being that he lost his leg fighting in the war, lost his leg because of the Germans, and so he doesn't want to see anything of them. And he knocks all these drawings out of the hands of a nurse who the bandaged patient had been showing his drawings to, clearly has a crush on her. And we see the guy with one leg kind of yelling at him, like, how could you, you know, be drawing pictures of these Germans? And there's a list on the wall of people that are missing and, you know, shot down and haven't been found. And we see a nurse and a doctor come and kind of escort the man with one leg away and try to calm him down. And meanwhile, on the wall behind the cook who's making dinner, it says days without supplies. And we see it's up to 14 days. So they hear a plane approaching, and they're wondering if it could be supplies. A couple of the nurses and one of the soldiers that's there to guard the hospital run outside to see if it's supplies. And sure enough, it's supplies, but it's a German plane, and it's enemy ace himself who is there bringing them supplies. So they're very happy to receive the supplies, but they're also a little wary that it's a German that's bringing them the supplies. And the enemy ace turns to leave, and one of the nurses grabs him by the arm and, you know, invites him in and, you know, hey, come and have a meal with us. Don't leave. You know, I'm sure you would like a warm meal. And so he relents, and he does, you know, again, World War II, the hospitals were neutral ground. He does relent. They eat together, and they're happy to have warm, fresh food. And the woman puts on a record, and actually the nurse that asked enemy ace to stay actually dances with her a little bit. And we see the soldier who has the bandage over part of his head, who drew the pictures earlier, looking on at enemy ace, maybe with a little bit of jealousy, but also with some angst. It's clear from the drawings he was making earlier that enemy ace is the one that shot him down, the one that caused him to lose his eye. And so he's harboring some ill feelings. So the dance finishes, and enemy ace notices the board where all the listed missing men are, and he walks over it to it and salutes them. And as he turns to walk away, we see that soldier with the bandage over his eye, his missing eye, and his partially covering his head, has found a pistol and has pointed it at enemy ace. And as he stands there contemplating pulling the trigger, the man previously who had knocked the pictures that the soldier whose head is partially covered by a bandage had drawn out of the nurse's hand, stays the gun. He has the man put his gun down, and he points up, reminding the soldier who's has the head wound covered in a bandage. They're in a hospital. They're in a church. It's neutral ground. And enemy ace walks up to that man with the one leg, who basically just saved his life, and holds out his hand to shake it, the soldier with the missing leg doesn't want anything to do with enemy ace. He just points like, you got to go. It's time for you to leave. And enemy ace does leave. He leaves the hospital. He leaves the church and flies off in his plane. And that ends the story. So it's a powerful story. You know, we've seen these types of silent stories before. And like I said, this one's really kind of a famous holiday story, kind of reminiscent of that real life story about American soldiers and German soldiers on Christmas Eve having a quote unquote silent night, where they kind of had a ceasefire for Christmas Day and came together to have a meal. It's very, very reminiscent of that. So it's a really great story. It's dedicated to Joe Kubert, who drew a lot of enemy ace stories back in the day. And like I said, John Byrne art, but Andy Kubert, Joe Kubert's father, or Andy Kubert, Joe Kubert's son, I should say, did a lot of the finishes. And you can see that he tried to do them in the style of his father. So it is dedicated to Joe Kubert and Bob Kaniger, actually, Robert Kaniger, who he was the writer on a lot of those enemy ace stories. And I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm 90% sure that Joe Kubert and Robert Kaniger created Enemy Ace. They were the comic creators who created the character. Up next, we have a Justice League story from William Meisner Loeb's. As the writer, Colleen Durand does the pencils, Ty Templeton on inks, Alberto de Guzman on letters, Tom McCraw on colors, and Mark Waid editing. This one is Hal Jordan and Barry Allen, and they're on monitor duty. And as their monitor duty ends, they decide that it's Christmas Eve and they need to go have some fun. So they're like, well, monitor duty's over. Let's go someplace. And like, Green Lantern's like, I don't know. There's got to be some small town somewhere that knows how to have an old fashioned Christmas. And so they head to a random small town, I guess. And they try to find some people with some Christmas spirit, but they're not having too much luck at it. First of all, it's raining, not snowing. And they give some money to a Santa who's ringing a bell to feed the poor. And Haldren says, Merry Christmas. He goes, yeah, right, money. That's what Christmas is all about. You're nothing with money. Without money, rather. People are scum. They're like, wow, you think we could have found a more Christmassy place? And as they're kind of walking along, they see some guy getting mugged. So they have to change into costume, and they stop the mugging. And then as the muggers go to jail, they find out that the guy being mugged is C.B. Finister, who apparently is one of the richest men on Earth. And they're like, well, what do you have? Because C.B. Finister says, you know, you might as well have let them kill me because life is meaningless. And like, wait, what? It's like, yeah, life's meaningless for me, and I'm C.B. Finster and I have all this money. What's it like for everybody else? Like, what's the point? And they're like, wait, you're one of the richest men on Earth. Like, why would you feel that way? He's like, but what does wealth matter when hope's gone? Like, what I realized today is humanity's worthless. I offered a fortune to any of my guests at the party that I threw tonight. If anybody could prove to me there is a Santa Claus, and they all refused and they all laughed at me. Like, man, when I was a kid, people were friendly, people were happy, but now everybody's small, they're greedy. I feel like everybody has withered, evil souls. And the difference is Santa Claus, when I was a kid, people believed in him. He brought joy to the world. Now there's nothing, there's no joy. It's like, man, I'd be willing to give $5 million to anybody who could prove to me that Santa Claus exists in this town. But you won't, no one will. And Flash and Green Lantern are like, are you serious? 5 million? We'll show you. We can do it. And so they actually dress up Finister as Santa Claus. And they start with the help of Flash's Speed, who goes around and, you know, buys a bunch of toys at super speed. And they have them in a big sack. And Green Lantern uses his powers to create a sleigh. And they start flying all around town and use their powers to help Finister be Santa Claus. And they hit every house in town. And throughout the night, Finister sees people that are dealing with, you know, some tough things. Some people have loss in their life. Some people have lost loved ones. Others are lonely and don't have anyone to spend the holidays with. And finally, at the end of the night, they have it's 6 a.m. They've managed to hit everybody in town but one. One family got overlooked, the Harpers, and it's because their house burned down and there's nothing there at their address. And they have no idea where they moved to. And so Flash and Green Lantern admit defeat. Well, I guess we blew it. And Finster says, wait, you given up? Like, well, we failed. Finster, Santa Claus doesn't overlook anyone. He's like, oh, yeah. Finster says, well, I suppose that's true. Like, anyway, you know, we'll be leaving you. Sorry we wasted your time. And they kind of fly off. And Finster's sort of standing there looking around, and he notices the station wagon. And he goes over and knocks on the window and says, are you the Harpers? And the father says, Santa Claus here? He said, well, yeah, kind of. Like, look, you got to be quiet. My wife and kids are sleeping in the back. Our house burned down. We can't afford a place to live. And you know, maybe I got some extra stuff that I can give you, says Finster. It's like, no, I appreciate it. But take them down the street to the shelter. There are people that are worse off than us. You know, we have our health. We have a warm car to sleep in. And you know, I got some presents. Mary loves sardines, and here's a silk flower I found outside the flower shop. She'll be able to watch the flower and look at it without the cold killing it. And Finster again, well, that's great. You gotta let me help you. And Flash and Green Lantern show back up, and they say, now you're talking. And Finster surprised to see him, like, wait, I thought you gave up. And they're like, no, not exactly. We had a hunch who was in the car. We thought it might be the Harpers, and we wanted you to realize that the Santa you've been looking for is you. Here's exactly what you have been looking for. It's in yourself. And Finster goes, you know what? You're right. And I'm keeping my end of the bargain. Here's your check for $5 million. And Green Lantern says, nah, you keep it. And Finster's shocked, like, you know, what? What? Like, we had a deal. And Green Lantern says, you know, people aren't really that bad. There's a lot of folks out there trying to help and being happy about helping, and they could use the money. Give it to somebody who really cares. And Fenster says, you know, I never really thought of it that way. You've given me a lot to think about. And I'm feeling really happy, and why not spread it around? And so what he does is he gathers up a lot of the people that he met throughout the night to spend Christmas Day together, all at the house of the one gentleman who hasn't had anybody in years to spend the holidays with. So it's a pretty heartwarming story, and definitely a reminder that we're all better together than we are apart. Up next, we have a dead man story. This one is, let me see if I can find, written by Alan Brennert, art by Dick Giordano, letters by Steve Hain, Tom McCraw on colors, Mark Wade editing. And we see dead man take over the body of this really rich jerk who he's got a net worth around $65 million, and basically a Wall Street shark buys up companies and, you know, breaks them apart, sells them for parts, and puts thousands of people out of work. And so dead man basically takes over his body, goes into a department store, buys tons of gifts for his friends to have them shipped out. And they're all to be shipped with a card that says Merry Christmas from Boston. Boston brand, of course, being dead man. And he also calls his office and orders 6 weeks severance pay to all the people that lost their jobs this year by what this guy did. So then he leaves the body, and he's thinking about how Christmas isn't his favorite time of year. There's so much goodwill around. There's not enough for him to do, and there's too much time to be alone and think. And, you know, he tried visiting some of his old friends one year, but it was just too weird. And so he kind of leaves them to their own devices at that time. And so instead he goes and he enters the body of somebody who's ice skating, just so he can kind of feel the wind on his face for a little while. And then he enters the body of somebody else who's ice skating, a man who clearly in love, the honeymoon phase, if you will. And he just plans on being in the body for a moment or two, but he's having such a good time, and it feels great to just be hugged and kissed, that he decides that he'll hang out for a little bit longer. They're heading to a Christmas party, and he ends up spending most of the night in this guy's body. And halfway through dinner, he starts realizing, as he's thinking about how nice it feels to feel like one of them and to feel like he belongs. And but he can't shake the feeling that it's not his Christmas. It's Paul's Christmas, the guy whose body he's in. And no matter which way you look at it, he's stealing the Christmas. And for all he knows, this could be Paul's last Christmas. Something bad could happen to Paul. And he doesn't have the right to take that away from Paul. So he leaves Paul's body. As he leaves, he can hear the confusion. Paul's, you know, all of a sudden waking up from the blackout, basically. And his friends are concerned, and dead man leaves, and he's cursing Rama, who's kind of the cosmic powered entity who kept him from completely passing to the afterlife, and charged him with you know, doing his job of righting wrongs as this disembodied ghost that Boston Brand is. And he says, "Is this the reward I get for serving you and your damn Lords of Order? I'm supposed to be grateful for this." Of course, Rama doesn't answer, and Bran is just sitting there on a bench thinking, "Some reward, all the good I do all year long, and this is what I get." And a woman walks up and says, is that why you do it, for rewards?" And dead man, Boston Brand, is taken aback, like, "What, you can see me?" And she says, "Obviously." And she compliments on his very seasonal costume, which is red. You know, so Christmas time, red costume. He says, "Thanks, I wear a green one on St. Paddy's Day. But who are you? Are you one of Madame Xanadu's mystic friends? Like, I know all the magic users." And the woman, a blonde woman, says, no magic. Magic and me have never been good companions, I'm afraid." It's like, "Well, then how can you see me?" She says, "Well, does it matter? A minute ago, you were raging against the gods for being alone, and now you have somebody who you can see you. Don't you just want to talk? Because I can leave you alone if you want." And Boston Brand's like, no, don't. But he's thinking, I thought I knew every sorcerer, every mystic, but on her, I'm drawing a blank. Like, I have no idea who this person is. And she says, could it be what's really bothering you is the fact that the people around us don't know what you've done? Like, you're not getting any credit for the good you've done. And Brand says, well, what if it is? Why should I be knocking myself out for anybody when they don't even know about it? Like, does anybody care that I'm getting no credit? She said, well, probably not. You are dead, right? Like, comes with the territory. People sort of forget about you when you're dead. And Brand's like, well, I feel so much better now. She's like, well, what do you want? You want recognition? You want glory? Is that why you do what you do? And Brand says, you know, there's something about her. Her tone, she's making me feel so small. I've been feeling like Job all along, like, you know, unappreciated and all these trials thrown in front of me. And now she's making me feel like Judas, like I've betrayed something. And Brand says, it's not just the glory. You know, I was a performer. I played to the crowd, the applause. And now it just seems like I'm forever playing to an empty tent. And I guess I just haven't gotten used to it. And the woman says, you know, you did soar and you were cut down at your height. And maybe there was a reason for that. We don't do what we do for glory or recognition. We do it because it needs to be done. Because if we don't do it, nobody will. And even if no one knows what we've done, even if no one knows we exist and no one remembers that we ever lived or ever did exist, it matters. It matters because we're doing what needs to be done. And Boston, kind of the light bulb kind of goes on. It's like, yeah, I guess we do, but don't mind me. I'm just a putt sometimes, you know? And the woman says, no, you're only human, Boston. You know, for being a dead guy, you're still human. So don't be ashamed of that. Rejoice in it, because it means your spirit, as flawed and as selfish as it can be sometimes, is still alive. You know, you're still in your own way, even though you're a dead guy, you're still human and you're still alive. And he thinks, alive, maybe so. And the woman says, well, I have to go. I have business to attend to. Merry Christmas, Boston. She starts to walk away. And he says, wait a minute. You didn't explain how you can see me and who you are. I don't even know your name. And she says, my name is Kara, though I doubt that'll mean anything to you. And he says, she's right. It didn't. I still don't know anything about her. And as he turns away, she disappears into the night. And Boston thinks, what she gave me that night, it meant so much. And even though I don't know anything about her, and I have a feeling I never will, maybe that was the whole point. He says, Merry Christmas, Kara, whoever you are. And we get a little dedication at the end. With respect and admiration for the works of Otto Binder and Jim Mooney, we still remember. Because again, this is 1989, this came out. Or maybe it was 1988. I can't remember. But anyway, it was right after Crisis on Infinite Earths had ended and DC had literally erased Kara Zor-El, had erased Supergirl from existence. So this Kara, it's Supergirl. And it was so impactful at the time. Obviously, it doesn't have as much weight now because they've brought her back, but it was a long time before they did. And it was such a jarring and sad moment when Supergirl died in Crisis on Infinite Earths. You know, that really famous cover with Superman holding her body and everybody in the DC universe, all the heroes behind him. You know, it's before internet, before you knew what was coming, character deaths, you know, months ahead of time. It was a shock. It's funny because her titles, she'd had, I think, two or three solo titles before that. And they never sold well. But yet when she died, man, you would think she was so beloved and there was such an outcry. You would have thought that her sales on her books must have been outstanding, but it wasn't the case. But seeing her show back up here, it was impactful at the time. And to hear, you know, Dead Man, if anybody understands Kara, what Dead Man goes through, it's going to be Kara, right? Because she's even worse off than Dead Man. At least the magic users of the universe, DC universe, still know Dead Man exists, still can communicate with him. Kara had been erased from everybody's existence, even Boston Brand himself. You know, he doesn't have any memory of her not sure who she is. She had been completely wiped out of existence, killed during the crisis, and then erased from existence when all the multiverses got merged. So it was a very impactful time, and love the little remembrance at the end with respect and admiration for the works of Otto Binder and Jim Mooney, who were the two creators who created Supergirl. We still remember. Just basically Mark Waid saying, we still remember that you created this incredible character. And even back then, Supergirl was all about humanity and compassion and empathy. And that's, you know, exactly what she's showing here for Boston Brand and what he's going through. And I love that the Future State stuff that's coming out, we covered it just recently, did a whole spotlight on it and talked about Supergirl establishing a base on the moon for people who didn't feel at home on Earth anymore. So even from this in 1988, 89, whenever, till now, you know, 30 plus years later, it's still at the core of the character, still at the heart of the character, how much compassion she has. So I have to say that overall, if I'm just comparing Christmas with the Superheroes 1, which is a collection of previous stories from, you know, different comics from different time periods that celebrate the holidays, and this one, which is all new stories, I actually prefer this one. And I think part of it is because the tone overall is a little more consistent. You know, part of the thing about that Christmas with the Superheroes, the first one, I talked about it at the time, how, you know, the Golden Age story or the Silver Age Christmas stories rather had such a different feel from the more modern ones, just depending on what time period they were pulled from and you know, who the creators were. This has a more consistent tone. They're not all the same tonally, but they're closer to being more consistent. So I think I prefer this one. Plus, they're new stories that I had never read before at the time. And I really liked it. Like I said, when I first read it, when it first came out, bought it off the stands, the Superman story, even though it is a little, I don't want to say depressing, but a little somber, I really liked. And then having Kara show up was, as I said, very powerful because she had been erased from existence. And of course, the John Byrne NMEA story, John Byrne at the height of his powers, NMEA's and Joe Kubert, art from his son inspired, looks like his style. I remember loving that story at the time. So yeah, all in all, I enjoy this one a lot more than the one that's a collection of already published stories. So this one, if you're looking for a good DC holiday special, this is up there, man. This is up there with ones that I would recommend. I would say go out and pick this up and read this as opposed, because you could probably find it for less than $10. And the, like we said on last week's new Comic Book Day episode, when I reviewed the DC Multiverse Christmas special from 2020, it's $10. You can probably find this for less than $10. I mean, 100% you can find this for less than $10. Maybe with shipping, it might be about $10. But I would recommend this that you can probably pick up for a couple bucks before I'd recommend that $10 multiverse one. These stories just mean more to me, and I think they're of higher quality. So not that that one's bad. You know, go listen to our new Comic Day episode, and I have a lot of good things to say about it. But I just love this one. It's one of my favorite holiday specials that DC or Marvel has ever done. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Source Podcast. As always, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.